Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. This episode features the great Tim Gallagher, NBA historian, expert in NBA and college basketball, wealth of knowledge, and we talk about a variety of subjects, primarily Fred Hoiberg, the new era of coaches in the NBA, more player-friendly. We talk a little bit about the upcoming the NBA Finals. This was recorded just before Game 1, so obviously Golden State won in overtime, and with the injury to Kyrie Irving, we probably all expect a pretty quick end to that series, Golden State in either a sweep or five games. So, but please enjoy this discussion on a wide variety of topics. You can reach me at chicagobullseye@gmail.com if you have any questions, or you can always reach me at Twitter at CBEFred, at CBEFred. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a good one.
Again, we have Tim Gallagher, NBA basketball historian, NBA expert on the line, and I appreciate you, Tim, for coming on the Chicago Bullseye again. Your last visit was met with great fanfare. People really enjoyed the discussion, so I'm really happy that you're coming back on again.
Well, thanks, Fred. It's good to be here.
We've got a couple topics to talk about, and a number of topics, you know, with the finals coming up. You know, I'd like to first start out with a little bit of your comments right now on the major topic of discussion at hand in Chicago, which is the Fred Hoiberg hire. If you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about Fred, what you know about him, your opinion of him, and this new breed of NBA coaches that are coming in, and a Steve Kerr that seemed to, like a la Steve Kerr, that seemed to be a lot more player-friendly as opposed to the old-school Tom Thibodeau, Bobby Knight type.
Absolutely. Well, Fred, with Coach Hoiberg coming to town, I guess he'll be the second most knowledgeable Fred in Chicago when it comes to basketball. So,
we got to wait. Yeah. I'm going to wait to make that judgment. I still might have him.
Well, first of all, I think it's a real credit to the Bulls that they got their man, right? I know there was some risk, some concern, you know, a lot of angst about the whole Thibodeau situation and the exit, but the fact that they were able to get the person it appears they've had targeted for quite some time, I think is a real credit to them. You know, how it's going to work out, we shall see, but I really liked the hire, especially as we've talked about a little bit, this kind of new breed of NBA coach, and when I say that, I mean more player friendly, you know, a little more of an understated approach, yet they have a certain presence, either from their playing days like a Steve Kerr or a Jeff Hornacek in Phoenix, or we're under the wing of a Coach Popovich like a Coach Budenholzer in Atlanta. You know, David Blatt obviously got most of his success internationally, so not as well known in the US, but you know, has a lot of credentials, and you know, there seems to be that spirit of collaboration and trust, I guess you could say, from the players all the way up through the front office. And that appeared to be you know, a lot of what was happening in Chicago that was causing the concern. You know, I kind of look at Coach Hoiberg as the Steve Kerr of the Midwest, you know, just in terms of his personality, his presence. What I mean by presence is, just as Steve Kerr is probably the most beloved player in the history of University of Arizona basketball. Not the greatest player, but just his contribution to the program and just personality and the success they had when he was there, there's, you know, been no one quite like him. And he's obviously carried that on into his NBA career and in the Suns front office and at the broadcast table and now, of course, with leading the Warriors to the finals. So, you know, kind of almost basketball royalty on that level, you know, a Kerr or the mayor, as Fred is known in Ames, where he's from. So, you know, not quite the level of Bill Russell, Jerry West, you know, Oscar Robertson royalty, but kind of that next level of royalty. So, and I've had a chance to see Hoiberg coach with Iowa State. I was in Dayton in 2013 when Iowa State played in the second and third rounds there, and so got a very close look at him on the sidelines. And that 2013 Iowa State team was a very good team. They beat Notre Dame handily, and that's a Notre Dame team that a lot of those guys were on the team that just took Kentucky to the ropes and, you know, had one of the great seasons in Notre Dame history. So, granted, those players were a couple years younger, but Iowa State, I went back and looked at the score, and Iowa State beat them by close to 20 points. And the other,
wow.
Then the game following that, Iowa State took Ohio State, which was playing in Dayton, which was almost like a home game for Ohio State, you know, even though it was the NCAA tournament, and it took an Aaron Kraft buzzer beater to win the game for Ohio State. So all throughout that process, and you know, in a game where they blew out a good Notre Dame team, and then in a real tight game, I really study coaches and their sideline demeanor and how they handle their team and interact with their players, and was very impressed with Coach Hoiberg and how he handled it all. And so I think obviously the key is building the right staff around him, but he does have NBA experience as a player. He was in the Timberwolves front office. So you know, I think his resume and style will be a refreshing change, but you know, obviously he's going to have to prove it on the court with winning ball games and advancing in the playoffs.
Absolutely. I think there are some similarities between you mentioned the kind of the analogy with Kerr and the similarities with him and Fred Hoiberg. I think there's some similarities to the situation where Kerr replaced Jackson, and where Hoiberg's replacing Thibodeau, with the obvious exception that Jackson obviously did not lose that team. His players were still devoted to him, and I think it's apparent to anyone who's paying attention that Thibodeau had lost the Bulls, without a doubt. But if you wouldn't mind, could you go over the situation in Golden State? You're on the West Coast. You're a little bit closer to that situation. And for our listeners, kind of give a little bit of detail about Jackson as a coach, and you know, his expectations and how the fan base in general felt about him. Probably pretty popular, I imagine, being replaced by Steve Kerr, and maybe draw an analogy or some similarities to the situation here in Chicago.
Sure, and I think it is very similar. Although last year's Golden State team, I still maintain if Bogut would have stayed healthy, he didn't play in the playoffs. So with a healthy Bogut, you know, Golden State might have continued on, and
good
Steve
point.
Kerr may not have gotten the opportunity and might have been coaching the Knicks, or who knows how it would have played out. But the fact that they were eliminated even without Bogut, they made a change. But you know, there were some things happening at Golden State kind of beneath the surface. Some of them came out through the media with some coaching changes. So you might remember Brian Scalabrine, who had some history with the Bulls, got demoted to coach in the D League. There was the issue with the assistant Darren Erman, who I saw just got hired on the Pelican staff, but he was fired for, remember there was that strange thing where he was recording conversations of mm-hmm. coaches meetings. So and then when Mike Malone left to go coach Sacramento, there was some criticism that of Jackson that Malone was the real defensive genius, and probably Erman as well, behind the team. Although obviously they persevered through all that off the court strangeness, but all that off the court strangeness kind of added up to something is not going right there. Right, there's some miscommunication, or there's some issue with from top to bottom in the organization. So that's where I think it's very similar to what happened with the Bulls. And, and I don't know that the Tibbs really lost the team either. There were some injuries, and, I just wonder if Gasol would have been healthy, if those pivotal games against Cleveland might have gone a little differently. I guess we can all look back and wish and hope it was different. But I think what was happening in Golden State, even with their success last year and the way the franchise was on the ramp up, there was some of that strangeness or uncertainty in the front office, and that led to the change. And so I think that's the same thing that happened in Chicago, where somewhere from that top to bottom in the organization, that line of communication was fractured. And I think, again, at least from what I can see and what I've heard, and a couple of the people that are on Golden State staff are from here in San Diego where I live, and so I've known them or known of them and interacted with them. So they're all very easy to get along with people, good communicators, and I think just like running a business, right? You want the vision of the CEO to really trickle down to administrative people on some of the entry level positions in the company. And you got to have that trust and collaboration. And so I think getting Hoiberg back in the organization is a step to build that. And I don't think that Foreman and Paxson are meddling in terms of, you know, every single offensive or defensive, you know, set that's run or things like that. But I think there just needs to be that kind of communication, like any business of, you know, interaction, communication, strategy. Are we on the same page? We're in this together to succeed. You know, just that kind of attitude. So I think, you know, as we talked a little bit on the last podcast, I think for better or for worse, things with Tibbs kind of ran their course, and I'm really excited for the Bulls that they were able to somehow get Hoiberg out of Ames. You know, that seemed like, for him, an ideal situation, but how many times does an opportunity like this come up, I guess, to be relatively close to home? You know, Chicago's not that far from Ames, obviously, and you know, a top-level NBA job.
Sure. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, I heard Doc Rivers recently and Mike and Mike mentioned that the offense clearly, you know, after Jackson and, you know, Kerr's year this season, clearly, he, in so many words, basically said, became far less predictable and far less simple, I guess, is probably the best way to describe his comments. What did you notice that was different under the Jackson team and the Kerr team in Golden State?
Yeah, well, I thought they've been pretty free-flowing teams, even with Jackson, and they seem to obviously have Curry and Klay Thompson with the green light. But and I think the emergence of Draymond Green and Harrison Barnes, you know, another year of experience for those guys. And speaking of new breed of NBA coaches, I think this new breed of NBA player, where it's kind of a hybrid, where a guy doesn't necessarily have a locked-in position, right? Even though Draymond Green's done everything from, you know, guarded the other team's five to bringing the ball up the court, you know, and running the offense. So I think the emergence of those two, you know, definitely made a difference. You know, and I don't know where they were last year, Golden State, in terms of defensive ranking in the league, but obviously they snagged Ron Adams away from Chicago, or, you know, Ron Adams was dismissed from Chicago, and they picked him up, and they were the leading defensive team in the league. So I thought that was an interesting acquisition on the coaching staff side of it, and it certainly paid off, you know, as they led the league in defensive efficiency.
Could you talk a little bit about the new trend in the NBA for three-point shooting, which, you know, Fred talked a little bit about in his press conference yesterday? Three-point shooting, going small, you know, playmaking power forwards in the league.
Right. Absolutely. Well, and, you know, this year there's all kinds of records that have been set for three-pointers, both on an individual level and you know, an cumulative level. And I think it's gotten to the point where the three-point shot is a routine shot now in the NBA. You know, it's not a heave or a desperation shot. And, you know, and I think it's interesting, as I've watched the games and watched the playoffs, that the defenses haven't adjusted more. And I'm thinking of a couple things there. One is that when the ball rotates from the weak side to, you know, to the shooter out at the three-point line, that, you know, the defensive player is racing out there, you know, and in such, where a guy like a Steph Curry can just even give a little, very minimal ball fake, and the defender is, you know, out of position, goes flying past him, and he's got an open shot. So part of it, I think, they almost have to do a better job of teaching how to close out on shooters, you know, which is a pretty fundamental thing. But you just see so many guys losing the shooter by being out of position or leaving their feet. The other thing is there's a tendency and an intuition as a defender that if somebody's penetrating with the ball, you help, right? And so the NBA corner three is like a free throw for a lot of players now. And so when you have a penetrating point guard, the person who's supposed to be defending that corner three just intuitively seems to always sag and try to help in the middle. The
yes.
Penetrating guard kicks it to the corner for a three, and I think that really almost needs to change, right? Because you'd almost be willing to give up a, you know, a relatively mildly contested two compared to an open three, that because threes are just so makeable now, right? And so
exactly.
I just think there needs to be more of a shift in terms of defensive strategy, defensive philosophy. And hey, as a fan, I love seeing people making threes. I appreciate great shooting. I like seeing the ball movement. But if you're the coach and you're the object is to win the game, I'm still surprised there haven't been more creative strategies, or you know, they can play zone in the NBA now, or just mixing up defenses. You know, you think about watching the NFL, and I just was really thinking through this in my mind, how innovative the NFL is in terms of changing defenses and you know, making adjustments, you know, almost possession by possession in some cases. And you know, the NBA still seems pretty set in terms of how they're defending. And
I you hit a great point. I felt that way about Thibodeau, where you know, he's going to run his defense, and if it's not working, you know, play harder. There's literally no creativity if a guy like LeBron is going crazy. You just continue to play the same way you've continued to play. There's no change. You know, there's really no, you're going to, you know, trap pretty much every pick and roll. And even though if your center is a guy like Pau Gasol, who obviously can't do it, you know, it's just frustrating. I was frustrated a lot during last year with his lack of creativity or lack of desire to try anything else. And you do see that in other teams. I mean, I saw the Spurs go to his own occasionally, you know, during the season. So, you know, I think that's a great point. That really, you know, we need a little bit, this flexibility and this creativity that we've had on offense over the past few years, I think kind of needs to happen also defensively.
Right. Well, and then the fact that this trend, kind of your other question that you'd asked about where teams go smaller, we talked a little bit about these hybrid kind of players, right? That, you know, there's guys in the finals, you know, a handful of them, you know, just off the top of my head, right? LeBron obviously can play just about every position on the court. Draymond Green, Harrison Barnes, Iguodala, Shumpert. So the fact that the teams are starting to be built for, you know, switch on everything kind of possessions late in the games. So even with that happening, though, there's still people getting a lot of open looks, right? A lot of open threes.
Yeah.
So I still think somewhere the defense is behind where it could be. But again, as a fan, I love the shooting. I love that. And then, it's just been interesting, too, to look at some of the playmaking fours. Obviously, Draymond Green is doing that. I guess you could call LeBron a four, or you could call him whatever you want, I guess. He can do it all. But it's also kind of an interesting trend now to see. And again, as a fan, I like seeing versatile players, guys that can do a lot of things that aren't so specialized. And so it's kind of fun to see,
Yep,
a Harrison Barnes type player, right? And you know, if we get to talk a little bit about the draft, you know, there's a number of those hybrid kind of players that are coming into the league. And you know, if I'm a GM looking to build my team, there's some intriguing prospects, you know, with those types of players.
So, Tim, I'd like to get your thoughts on the NBA Finals preview and prediction for what we expect to see starting on Thursday.
Sure. Well, my hunch and intuition is the Warriors in six, and for a couple of reasons. One is Golden State having the home court advantage, which you know, I still think that does mean something, and especially in Oakland where they rarely lose. The second is just the depth of Golden State, and I know Cleveland's had some injuries, and somehow they've pieced it together with not a deep bench, and getting mileage out of guys like James Jones, who you know obviously is pretty one-dimensional, a shooter, but you know certainly a savvy veteran. But that you know that they're relying on those guys at key points of games. You know, I guess is it more of a credit, I guess, to LeBron and some of the others that are carrying the load that they can hide those guys or just utilize them for their strengths. But I still think Golden State's depth is a big advantage. And then finally, I mentioned Rod Adams before. I think Golden State's defensive schemes. I hoping and thinking that they're going to do some creative and different things to try to slow down LeBron or Kyrie or isolate on some of those key guys and then make the others beat you. I know on the last podcast when the Bulls were still in it with Cleveland, I said, well, you need to make Dellavedova and Tristan Thompson beat you, and they kind of did. But
absolutely.
But I think that's where you have to roll your dice, right? I'm still surprised nobody has flattened Dellavedova. I mean, I appreciate that he's a scrappy hustler and, you know, gritty player and you know,
I'd
really
say
playing well.
I'd say Horford did his best. you know, trying to plant them. But I agree with you there. Hey, to wrap this up, we're going to get into draft in the next. I hope you can come on with us again next week. We're going to start our draft previews over the next few weeks.
Sure.
But I do want to wrap this up with a little bit of discussion, that we had you had suggested, which I'd love to hear a little bit on, the memories of the 1975 Warriors, who were the NBA champs. You know, basically, they went through the Bulls in order to get there, with the Bulls being in the Western Conference at that time. Could you provide us with some memories over that team, and especially the series against the Bulls?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you dig somewhere on YouTube, I know they have that Game 7. I've seen it. It's not been recently, but the Bulls have to play on the road in Oakland, and they take them down to the last few minutes. I mean, the Bulls really play well. And I think that Bulls team at the time, of course, that's the Sloan, Van Leer, Bob Love, Chet Walker, Bullwinkle. That was the core unit. And I was looking at the ages. That was probably kind of their last realistic shot of going the distance, right? That team had been together for – that core group had been together for a while. And obviously a great team under Dick Motta and, a lot of success. But it was interesting, too, with Golden State, that a former Bull, Clifford Ray, was their starting center. So, it was a memorable series. I watched it quite closely. A couple of interesting little tidbits, too, about that series. If you go back, the Warriors' home court was the Oakland Coliseum, now known as Oracle Arena, where they play now, and it's certainly been renovated since 75. But the Ice Follies were booked at the Coliseum, so that's how unlikely it was that the Warriors were going to get to the finals. So the arena was booked for something else, so they ended up having to play two finals games at the Cow Palace,
unbelievable.
Where the Warriors had played, back in the day, and, where they, just the perspective of the NBA, the stature of the NBA today compared to then, right? Can you imagine a team playing in the finals and getting bumped because of the ice fall?
Hey, the United Center is, we got something planned for it. Sorry, Bulls. I mean, that is unbelievable. So really quick, though, do you recall, Tim, I had the pleasure of meeting Bob Love last year. I believe the Bulls traded Clifford Ray before that season to San Francisco or Golden State, and also was it Nate Thurmond in return? Is that correct?
Right. Yes, Nate Thurmond was the backup center for Bullwinkle on that 75 Bulls team. And so, it was an interesting flip-flop of a former Bull and a former Warrior playing against their former teams there.
Why did they make that trade?
I'm not sure. Certainly Nate Thurmond was kind of at the tail end of his career at that point. And so, I'm not sure what was behind that. I'll have to do a little research on that. I'm not sure. But the other thing that, just another quick memory of that finals, Rick Barry, of course, was the star of the Warriors at the time. And fans today will know of all his sons that are broadcasting and and made their own name in the NBA, but Rick Barry, that was kind of the icing on the cake of his career, getting the championship that year, and had some incredible seasons with the Warriors. And one thing I remember too is the Bullets had a player named Mike Reardon, who was a very good player and played on the Knicks championship team, but he basically was assigned to make Rick Barry's life miserable, and I was thinking, in our terms today, he kind of went Dellavedova on Rick Barry, and basically was trying to agitate him enough to get Rick Barry ejected from the game. Although instead, Mike Reardon got ejected from the game, and the Bullets were kind of expected to sweep that series, and it went the exact opposite. The Warriors swept them, so that was a Bullets team with Elvin Hayes, Wes Unseld, Kevin Porter, who's a Chicago native, a Chicago high school legend, was the point guard for the Bullets then. So pretty memorable series, and kind of an unexpected championship run by the Warriors.
I do remember talking to Bob Love about that series in the Western Conference Championship Finals, and I specifically looked at how many minutes he had played. He had played a ton of minutes in that series, and there was somewhat of a controversy at that time after reading some of the the papers back then that, you know, Dick Motta had overplayed his team. A lot of similarities to the current era. And I asked Bob, hey, you know, basically, was there anything to that? Did you feel worn out? And he admitted that, you know, he was on Rick Barry, you know, for most of that series, and it took something out of him trying to go through screen after screen to cover Rick Barry on one end and still bring it offensively, which I thought was pretty interesting. But
it's interesting you mention that, because, you know, I would say Tibbs and Dick Motta are very similar in terms of their, you know, just their styles and temperament. And, you know, I hadn't really thought of it that closely until you just mentioned that. But, you know, I guess Tibbs is thought of in kind of an old school way, and Motta was one of those, you know, my way or the highway kind of coaches, although very successful, you know, with Chicago, and, you know, kind of had a similar run that Tibbs did, you know, but, you know, couldn't quite get over the hump and get to the finals.
And isn't that similar to Tibbs in the playoffs?
Right. Right.
You know, neither guy has won anything yet, and I honestly don't think Tibbs will. I don't think he's ever going to have a team as good as what he had this year, no matter where he goes. So, you know, unless he goes to Cleveland next year or something like that. But, you know, we'll see. Hey, Tim, I got to run. I can't thank you enough for the time you've given to us. And I'm really looking forward to having you on again. We're going to get a little bit more draft talk. And also, obviously, we're going to review the finals and how the games go.
Sounds great, Fred. Well, great talking with you, and enjoy the finals.
Sounds great, brother. I'll talk to you soon, okay?